That's not the latest instalment of Slow Radio. That is the desk fan that normally calls me when I'm on the turbo, but it's just calling me while I'm sat down making service course today. It's very, very muggy in this shed. Hello, it's Tom here. Just a quick heads up about this episode. There's loads in it. That's why I'm here to tell you about that stuff. Lizzie has been covering the All Points North, don't call it a race, which is a 1,000-kilometre, don't call it a race, which started and ended in Sheffield. I've been speaking to Marcel from New Motion Labs about their experience at Eurobike, which was their sort of coming out party. I think their first coming out party was on this show. And there's also a little bit of a look back on the Olympics and Paralympics as well, which was a bit of a feast of cycling tech. Anyway, here's the show.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Well, this morning, Lizzie, I was a little disappointed that I hadn't taken up your offer to go on a bike ride with you. But as we speak, as the rain comes down, I'm pretty glad I missed it. You were at the Tour of Britain today.
I was indeed. Hello, Tom. Nice to see you. Yeah, I rode over to the top of the Brickworks climb where the Tour of Britain came
through. A local classic.
Yeah, absolutely. And met up with Lionel and Simon Gill, who have been covering the Tour of Britain this week. And yeah, it was so good to be back at a bike race. Even though I have to say, it's kind of a little bit disappointing being on the other side of a bike race. They arrive and then they go so quickly and then it's over. But it was very exciting nonetheless.
Well, I mean, actually, around here, it's always the way. There's always a Tour of Britain stage that sort of comes through sort of Cheshire, around Manchester. It tends to be the case. And it's always nice to go out and watch it. I know my next-door neighbour was out there with Buxton CC watching it. But the big thing about you going to this bike race, Lizzie, I know for a fact that the Brickworks from Sheffield, that's quite a way. So you must be recovering quite well.
I am indeed. Cushion. Yeah, actually, we bumped into a couple of friends of the podcast out on the climb, which was really, really nice. And yeah, it's actually been kind of looking back at the episodes that I've done of Service Course since I came back from my recovery break. It's been a really good kind of set of milestones for me to kind of look at where I was at this month and then this month and then this month. And I, you know, I'm 96% there now, and it's just, you know, a couple of final tweaks, and it's just such a relief, you know, to ride over, to talk to people I've never met before, and people I haven't seen for a long time, ride back, have really no symptoms. And I guess the only thing is at the moment that I've still have a little bit more fatigue than I would usually have, but compared to what I had at the beginning, it's nothing. I mean, at the beginning I would get up and get dressed and make a cup of tea and then have to lie down for 2 hours, and now, yeah, I did 14 hours training last week after, yeah, a few weeks ago I was barely doing anything, and yeah, I was a little bit tired, but it's normal when you come from nothing. So it's such a relief to really be in the very final stage, and the light at the end of the tunnel is right there, and it's just kind of a few little tweaks that I need to get right and keep working on. But what a relief, good to be back. Yeah, just to feel normal, you know, like the first days that I felt normal were they were so special, but then I obviously overdid it and then had days when I didn't feel normal, so it was so frustrating. But now it's, you know, normal more often than not, and yeah, nearly there. So
And you were saying before we started recording that full training hours around the corner.
Yeah, I'm hoping to be back. I'm building it up slowly now because obviously I wasn't doing very much. There was a period where I built up the training more, and then I actually backed it off because I got to the point where I was practicing training and I was practicing my physio exercises, but everything else was compromised. I wasn't actually practicing being a normal human, going to the supermarket, interacting with people, doing the washing up, emptying the dishwasher. So we made a decision to back off the training and to focus on real life rehab. And at that point, that was kind of July and beginning of August, when I backed off that training, I had such a huge increase in what I was able to do. And then kind of it just then went from there exponentially. The more I could cope with, the faster I got better. And yeah, so now I'm just slowly increasing the hours, the intensity, hoping to be back to normal training hours end of September, beginning of October. That's the goal. And yeah, seems perfectly doable. So it's really nice.
Well, we'll hear Lizzie's report from All Points North in just a bit. But right now we're going to change gears and we're going to go over to Eurobike. I mean, Eurobike, if you don't know, is probably the world's biggest bike show. It's certainly one that captures the media attention every year. It's the sort of place where people go to unveil big, big new products. And, well, I wanted to be there myself, actually, but obviously things are a little bit difficult. So hopefully next year we can go. But a couple of friends of the podcast were there, and we're going to speak to one of them now. This is Marcel Fowler from New Motion Labs, who you may remember we spoke to maybe back in January, December, when they unveiled their new Enduro chain technology. And they were at Eurobike to launch a new product as well.
For a company like yours, you know, sort of the journey to being at Eurobike, I mean, that is very, very significant, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really was our coming out party at Eurobike. This was the first time that we met with industry. You know, we met with the likes of Shimano and loads and loads of cargo e-bike manufacturers and all of the reporters and cycling media. So it was a very, very significant step forward for us. And we were able to show our technology on bikes to everybody.
How did you find Eurobike as an experience?
I mean, it's pretty manic. I mean, it's great to have everybody in under one roof, and everybody who develops all tech for cycling, and so you can almost build a bike from just the people under that one roof. So I really like the excitement. I really like the innovation, you know, that we saw at Eurobike as well.
Well, I'm going to talk about what you unveiled and, you know, your products and stuff. But I was just interested, you know, what you sort of spotted doing the rounds there, what was launched. Because I've got to be honest, you know, I've not really looked at a huge amount of the press coming out of Eurobike just yet. You know, there's been a lot of cycling going on. So what did you make of it? You know, what did you see?
I mean, the three things that came out to me was classified system. In which they have a rear hub, and therefore you just have a 1X drivetrain, and it's really easy to shift the front under load. Mm-hmm. I think it's a tremendous development, and really will simplify the whole of the front of the derailleur. Second, I saw a company that had inflating and deflating tires depending on the conditions where you're going to be going, which I found really, really kind of novel. The third one was the company that have kind of separated the rear cassette from the wheel. And so both the front wheel and the rear wheel are exactly the same now. And they put the bearings into the cassette. So you can easily just take off the rear wheel and put it back on within seconds.
You said to me when we chatted, we had a catch up, you were saying it's very much Euro e-bike this
year.
Yes,
yeah. I mean, you know, since the pandemic, you know, there's been 50-60% year-on-year growth in cargo bikes and e-bikes. Everyone suddenly discovered that they don't need really a car to travel around their road. Everyone's kind of got their own mountain bike exploring. And so I would say 70-80% of the bikes I saw were e-bikes.
Wow. It's funny, so I'm actually, you know, I'm of that sort of age, stage in my life now where the cargo bike, particularly something that I could dump two small children into and, you know, and still get up a hill. You know, and actually that's where kind of you guys come in. Because we'll speak a little bit, you know, about your, the chain we spoke about, you know, back in sort of December, January time. But you were there actually to launch another product that you've been developing, right?
Yeah, so we were launching the dual engagement sprocket called the Enduro Evolve. And it uses the same principle as the chain drive, but it uses a conventional roller chain and enables it to undergo this dual engagement, which is transferring power on both sides of the tooth and therefore not moving, reducing friction and therefore increasing lifetime and durability and efficiency.
And this is specifically for cargo e-bikes, that sort of stuff.
So this is specifically for any kind of cycling application. For cargo, we can increase lifetime by up to 30% just with the change of the tooth profile, but using the same chain. And then for kind of track cycling, we can go up to above 99% drivetrain efficiency. So it depends on which kind of what you're interested in, really.
Well, that actually brings me on to something else I wanted to ask you about. And we did touch on this when we were chatting the other day, but I really wanted to talk to you because I really wanted your sort of basically, since we spoke, I'm sort of now attuned to stuff about chains. And obviously, I've spoken to the people at Driven, and I've read various articles. And one of the articles that I wanted to talk to you about, it was actually pre the Olympics. So we can actually talk about the Olympics instead. But it was about the chain that GB were using, their revolutionary chain they were using. I just wanted your take on the tech, really, and what you made of it.
Yeah, I mean, so there are two ways in which you can increase the efficiency of a transmission tech. So you can stop the relative movement, which is what we're doing. So with the Enduro technology, or you can reduce the pitch, which the GB chain did. And by reducing the pitch,
just explain the pitch. I still can't get my head around a lot of these terms, but explain pitch to people if they don't know.
So the pitch is the distance between the teeth. And so what the GB team did is that they went from 13 millimeter, which is half inch, to about 10 millimeter, which is 3/8 inch. And by doing that, it meant that the chain moved less when transferring power. Basically, chains lose energy when they're moving while transferring power. And by making a smaller chain, it meant it moved less while transferring power.
So that was Marcel from NewMotion Labs. And if you want to hear the episode that they first featured on, I think it was from about January, and we'll put that in the show notes as well. But Lizzie, over to you.
Well, this month I have been indulging myself, Tom. I we call ourselves more than a tech show here on Service Course, and this is very loose tech. This is really an overlap with Explore, but this is something that I've been wanting to do for over a year now. So this past month, actually just this past week, I covered an event called All Points North, which is a 1,000-kilometer ORDAX starting and finishing in Sheffield. And this race was supposed to take place in 2020, and like so many things, was delayed and then cancelled and then delayed again. And it was really a relief for it to finally be able to happen in this month in September. And I guess my interest in kind of ultra endurance, ORDAXs, and really I'm not a specialist on the terminology here. Please forgive me if I say the wrong thing. I guess that started really when I was following Mark Beaumont's Round the World in 80 Days trip back in, three, four years ago now. And that was kind of as I was getting into cycling, and I was following him on YouTube. And then from then, I've been following Lachlan Morton's progress with EF Education First last year. He did this amazing ride at GB Duro. Mark Beaumont actually won GB Duro again this year. And over on the EF YouTube channel, there's some brilliant, brilliant films from that. Again, Lachlan Morton, he's obviously been converting the pro peloton over to ultra endurance riding. And he did his Alt Tour, where he rode the Tour de France route and all of the transfers between, and it was over 5,000 kilometres. So all of that has really piqued my interest in ultra endurance and ORDAX riding. So with that in mind, I headed off to the start of the event at All Points North over at a different gear bike shop in Sheffield this Saturday evening. And first off, we'll hear from Angela Walker, who's the organiser, followed by some of the absolutely brilliant characters who are taking part in this race. So I'm here at a different gear with Ange Walker, who is the organiser of All Points North. So, Ange, can you explain to me the format of this race and how it works for all the riders?
Okay, so there are 10 control points scattered all around the north of England. Riders leave Sheffield and then they have to get to the other 10 control points in any order that they want to get them. So they plan their own route. It's a completely free route. Do all 10, come back to Sheffield, hopefully before Wednesday lunchtime.
And roughly how far are the riders going to have to go?
It's we try to make it as close to 1,000 kilometres as we can. So I've done, you know, 6 or 7 different route configurations to try to make sure that we get the distance. I think one of the riders I spoke to today has managed to get their route down to 933, which is the lowest that I've heard.
Does that mean that they have to go off-road and on gravel and then compromise on speed, though?
No, they shouldn't have to, no. I've tried to design it because I want to make it as accessible as I can to people. I've tried to keep it purely on-road, so all the control points can be reached by road. I guess they could cut some corners by going off-road, but then they're probably going to lose a little bit of time because, you know, it's unsurfaced. So
yeah, totally. And so there's the start here in Sheffield, the finish here in Sheffield, and 10 points between there. And these points are scattered everywhere. The northernmost point is right up on the Scottish border. The westernmost point is Honister Pass, which in itself is a brute. And the easternmost point is Beverley North Bar, but also you've got to go up to the coast further up there as well.
So we always try to make sure we get one control as close to the border as we can, one on the east coast, which is Runswick Bay this year, and one on the west coast, which is Silverdale this year. So we've got to try to get, you know, a north, south, east and west.
And one interesting point when I was reading through the rules is it says you have to start and finish with all the same kit. So you can't start with your sleeping bag and then go, oh, hold on, it's nice weather, I don't need this, I'm just going to chuck this in the bin. And also no aid. You know, some other races say if people are dot watching and they turn up with a bottle on the side of the road, you can take it. This one says no aid, absolutely, so totally kind of self-sufficient.
You've got to say no. As long as it's commercially available to all riders, then you're allowed. So if you go into a bar and you want to buy a drink and it's in opening hours and any rider can do that, then that's no problem. But if somebody's standing at the side of the road offering you a bottle of water
because you're their favourite rider,
absolutely, you've got to say no, I'm really sorry, it's against the rules of the race. Now obviously we can't police that when we're out there, but we like to think that the riders take it in the spirit that it's meant and do try to stick to the rules as much as possible.
Totally. It's great to see this race back, actually, because it first started in 2019 and then obviously, for obvious reasons, we couldn't race it last year, but you actually had not all points north, didn't you?
Right,
so
yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So last year we tried really hard to figure out a way that we could still make the event happen, you know, under kind of COVID restrictions. So what we decided to do was, because we'd already plotted the routes and a lot of the riders had already designed their course, we decided to let people, just as a completely free event, just ride their route, but all on the same day. But they could start and finish at any control point that was near to their house, so they didn't have to come to Sheffield to start. So we had like a couple of guys who lived up in Scotland, so they rode to the nearest control to them, rode the race and then rode home. And then we looked at everybody's times and kind of figured out that way who managed to do most of them. So a lot of people really enjoyed it, and some riders on the route still ended up kind of meeting up with one another along the way, so it worked out pretty well actually.
So finally, we are officially a tech show. We like to bring that interpretation a little bit loose sometimes, but what's kind of, I'd say, either the weirdest, wildest or wackiest setup you've seen going on in this race so far? And obviously it's a young race, you know, 2-3 years, but what have you seen that's been, I have to say, I'd never seen these tail fins before, and we talked to some of the riders with those, which you'll hear from soon, but I'd not seen those before, but I guess that's kind of normal for your
racks. Tail fins have become pretty standard now, they're really nice lightweight racks, so we do see quite a lot of those. I'm trying to think in terms of strange setups. A lot of riders are using aero bars. I've seen some aero bars that are like super high off the, you know, off the drops. So that's been quite interesting, seeing the difference in all the different types of aero bars that people are using. We've got our first tandem this year.
I did interview them. You'll hear from them later, which is really interesting. They're on a Galaxy Doors twin bike with a big pannier rack, and they've got mattresses on the back. they also had a pizza attached to their pannier rack, which I thought was brilliant. So yeah, it's great to see kind of more diverse entries, I guess. No cargo bikes.
We've not had a cargo bike yet.
No babies on the front or back.
I did see somebody arriving on a cargo bike today, and I thought, oh my god, is he actually going to ride it on that? But no, he's just a spectator, thankfully. So we've not seen anything too crazy really. We had one single speed last year, And we had somebody do it on fixed last year. I don't think we've got any this year that I can.
That'll be a brave rider going up Honest to Pass on a fixed gear.
Yeah. But the first time we did it, he went up. He went up the struggle. In Ambleside fixed. Well, I think he probably ended up walking most of it, but he had to go. He got round. So
fastest riders. Hoping to be in on Monday. When are you going to open the checkpoint, the final checkpoint at Healey Institute? Expecting the riders.
Yeah, we're gonna open late Monday afternoon. So Pavel Pulaski, who got with the first rider back in 2019.
We will hear from him later.
He did it last time in, I think, about 46 hours. So this year we've put an extra control in to try to make sure that riders must kind of stay to the distance, because I think the first time we run it, some people got their route down to around about 800. So, but like I say, this year we think it's a lot higher than that. So I'm not expecting him to be as soon back, but last time he had 20 minutes rest, and this time he's saying, oh, maybe I don't need that 20 minutes rest. So.
And you just kind of follow the dots, and if they're coming a bit early, you just open up early.
Yeah. We're kind of, because we've got the Audax coming back tomorrow anyway, so we're around most of the time. So if it looks like people are going to start arriving back sooner, then we'll open up earlier. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Callum Rogers. I'm rider number 11 at All Points North.
Okay, so the reason I've come over to Callum's bike is because I've been told about his super fancy mudguards when I was on the lookout for some cool tech. So just to describe them to you, they are silver-looking, rippled effect, full mudguards. What can you tell me about them?
Sure, for people looking on Google, they're called Velo Orange Wavy Fenders, and they're 58mm, and they're for 650B wheels. When I got this bike last October, this is a Surly Midnight Special. I showed my mate on Instagram, of course. This is the bike I'm getting, and he said, you should get some nice mudguards with that, because it's on Cycle to Work scheme. So obviously, there's no VAT on Cycle to Work scheme stuff, so here they are. And they've got Gilles Baudet leather flaps on as well, which I think were like 50 quid, but
yeah,
whatever.
And looking really cool is an important part of having a lot of motivation to go faster and further.
Exactly, and but I've done my share of rides and wet weather, and when it's really wet, it's just like being power hosed in the crotch, unless you've got guards on. So I'm glad I've got them on, and they do a cracking job. They make a lovely noise if you're going over like gravel as well, little ding 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 ding, ding noises. It's brilliant.
Totally, and I think with a race like this, when it's 1,000 kilometres, and 2 days ago we looked at the weather forecast and it was saying it was going to throw it down all weekend.
Wait, I didn't know it was a race.
Well, okay, sorry, 1,000 kilometre event. Sorry. Did you know what you were getting yourself in for? But I mean, like, the weather's so unpredictable. We're in the north of England. You're going from East Sheffield only north.
Yeah.
And if it's going to be wet, it's going to be miserable. And so a lot of people end up scratching races because...
Well, I've been following Katie Butler on YouTube for a long old time, and her footage of what it was like 2 years ago really made me bring my sort of kitchen sink with me, because I'm completely mindful it can just turn at any second, and I'd really rather, if it slows me down a little, to have a bunch of spare layers and I get to the end not wearing some of them, like, bigger problems.
I'm trying to recall the race that was a few months ago up in the northwest, but I had a head injury, so I do have a good excuse for not remembering it, and so many riders scratched. It was up in the Lake District and around Forest of Bowland, around there. No, I can't remember either. Anyway, I think, you know, only a few riders finished because it was just through an absolutely horrendous storm. And like you said, if you're prepared, then you can actually get through that. So can you just quickly talk us through the rest of your equipment? You've got a big old retro Caradise bag on the back.
Yeah, so that's I really love Caradise stuff. I think it looks lovely. And I think that bag set me back like 20 quid off of a forum called London Fixed Gear and Single Speed. I've repaired some of it using a Sailmaker sailing kit. Which was a couple of quid off the internet. So, and you can wax it yourself just with a tin of waxed wax paraffin, and then hair dryer it so it seeps into the canvas and it's waterproof.
Love it.
And I need to get around to sewing stuff on it at some point, but at the moment it fits all my lunch.
I love that, because I think one of the big barriers to kind of bikepacking in Audax events is the cost of things. So I love that you say that you can just get it for 20 quid. And what have you got on the front of the bike?
So on the front are two Planet X adventure cages, I think they're called. I think the bundle was like 20 quid for the lot, and an Outkit airlock 20 litre bag, which has been really terrific. That's just got my sleeping bag in at the moment, and a Planet X frame bag, and a Planet X food bag, and a Planet X bottle bag for the handlebars, and more Planet X time trial levers, And so yeah, that's the front.
I guess the big question here is, how much does this bad boy weigh? Because you've got to get up some serious hills over the next few days.
I mean, it weighs what it weighs.
Yeah.
You know, my old bike was made of Reynolds 853 steel with a carbon fork. And when I got this bike last year, the bike industry, you get less for your money these days. So I have kind of downgraded to 4130 chromoly, but that's just what's on the market these days. And I've enjoyed the robustness that this bike has offered me, because it can go off-roading, on-roading. You know, yeah, it's not the lightweight of All Points North, but I like this bike a lot.
I feel like this is a purist bike. Well, good luck, wishing you all the best, and hope you have a safe trip.
Thank you so much. Have a good one yourself.
Hi, I'm Pavel Bławski. Yeah.
And so, actually, I'm graced with the winner of the very first All Points North, and the only previous All Points North, because unfortunately last year it got cancelled and it became not All Points North. Mm-hmm. So not really a race.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be back at All Points North 2021? And it's a bit of a bigger challenge this year, because it's more like 1,000 kilometres, and was it only about 500 in 2019?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to be back. I was waiting for this event for like, I think, more than 2 years now. Yeah, more than 2 years. So yeah, it's super that we could, that, you know, it can happen. And I think, yeah, the last year was, the distance was nearly 900 k's for me, kilometers. This year, yeah, the Angela said it will be longer, but my route has like 950 k's. So yeah, it's pretty 1,000 k's. Yeah, but it's definitely more climbing this year, yeah.
And I'm looking at your bike, but could you quickly tell me what kind of setup you have for the listeners? Because I would say that this is a skimpy setup, but it's probably what I would go for, because at the end of the day, you don't have to race it, but it is a race, and weight matters, doesn't it? So you've really got very little on the bike there, but can you talk us through it?
Yeah, I mean, I went for light bike because I know it's lots of climbing here, and the hills are steep. It's not really high here, but there's like constant up and down. It's my experience from the 2019. And I'm after quite a long race and not really recovered. So I think having less on bike will be easier for me. And setup is just like I always go. I use steel bike, steel frame with carbon fork. It's a custom-made frame from Poland, Wrocław, Hulte Bikes, and two custom bags, like frame bag and front bag.
But they're very small bags, so you've got a half frame bag, very narrow, and a very small front pack, so you must not have many kind of clothes that you're not planning on sleeping, you're not planning on getting cold or wet.
No, I got a rain jacket inside, I got like a warm jacket for colder hours, I got sleeves and leg warmers. Actually, I got pretty a lot of clothes inside.
I don't believe you.
I will show you. But that's true. I don't have really proper sleeping kit.
Yeah. So do you not plan on sleeping, or are you just planning on finding a couple of hours in a bus stop with a down jacket?
Yeah, this is probably the plan. My flight is on Tuesday evening, so I don't have too much time, really.
Yeah, it's only 2.5 days till then, so 3 days till then. No worries. Well, good luck. Wish you all the best, and hope to see you first across the finish line.
Thanks a lot. See you later.
So we've just had a chat from Angela Walker, the organiser, and it's finished now, about 20 minutes to start, and there's a lot of nervous faces around. The participants have just been informed that at the northernmost point of the route, which is up a Cockettdale, there is a firing range which you can't actually access the checkpoint between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Monday, and 9 a.m. and midnight on Tuesday. So some of the participants hadn't worked this out in their research, so I think there's going to be a bit of a mad scramble to make sure the routes go the right way, and everybody's going to get to that point before 9 a.m. on Monday.
So I'm here with Nikki Short, who actually has been an inspiration for me. She was at university with me and went on my first ever university club ride about 8 years ago, and I don't think I've seen Nikki since. I just told her the story, and Nikki's probably one of the hot favourites for the women's race this year. How do you feel about that, Nikki?
Well, that's what I've been told. Sorry to drop that on you.
Yeah, that's the first I've heard of it, so Let's see if I can live up to that expectation.
Well, you come into this, okay, well, we didn't really have any races last year for obvious reasons, but in 2019 you had a pretty good Audax season, didn't you?
Yeah, well, actually last year I did manage to squeeze in one race in between the various lockdowns. So I did the Two Volcano Sprint, which was in October.
And where was that for non Audaxes?
That was in Italy. It wasn't actually an Audax, it was an ultra race. How far was it? 1,000 kilometres between Mount Vesuvius and Mount Etna. So a hell of a lot of climbing in that.
Should prepare you well for this race, around the same distance, also a lot of climbing.
Well, that race was like double the amount of climbing in the same distance. So this should be
easy.
A walk in the park compared. Yeah. So we'll see about that.
So can you talk me through your setup? That is what I'm really interested in, the techie side. Yeah. It's pretty light setup, which again, I think that's pretty good. That's what I'd go for.
Yeah, it looks pretty light. It's unfortunately, it is heavier than it looks. I don't know where all the weight is. I think...
Have you weighed it?
No, never weigh a race bike. It'll just weigh on your mind. And then you'll think, well, to be honest, this is the heaviest it will be because of obviously fully loaded with the food and water especially for the first night, because we're setting off at 8 o'clock, so you have to be able to sustain yourself for like the next sort of 10 hours.
And a lot of the places, of course, that you're going are in the middle of nowhere, so there's not petrol stations and things like that all around, and
yeah,
all 24-hour shops. So
absolutely, I think it's going to be sort of 300 kilometres before I plan to make my first stop, so I really want to be able to just keep on going. So I'm also got a camelback on my back. It's got a litre of water in there, and then I've got another litre of water actually on the bike itself. So I mean, yeah, that's the main thing, especially riding at night. You need to make sure you've got enough water, because you can't run out of water halfway through the night and then, you know, just be finding the first petrol station in the morning.
And then, yeah, in terms of bags, you've got a very small saddle bag, a small top tube bag, and a very small frame bag. So it is minimal, but it looks like you have everything you need.
It's similar to the setup that I had for Two Volcano Sprint, and with it being similar in distance as well, I sort of know the fact that I'm not really planning on having any extended stops. So I've cut out the bivy kit. I haven't got any. I've got an emergency bivy, which just packs down to, you know, the size of your fist, so it really doesn't take up that much space at all. And it's just the essentials. Actually, electronics take up.
I was just about to ask. So a really important thing, of course, is safety. So the riders are starting from Sheffield at 8 p.m. and it's going to take the best riders. Best riders might be back on Monday, then Tuesday we expect everybody back, but
that's
you've
right.
got to be self-sufficient with charging, and you have to have lights for the whole time. And how do you do that? Do you just take battery packs with you? Do some people have dynamos?
I've never had a dynamo. I always just rely on a battery pack, so I've got a 10,000 milliamp battery pack, and I've also got a battery cell for my exposure light at the front. So the battery pack will just power my phone and my Wahoo, and then I've got the separate charger for my light, so I should be okay.
And you've never run out before?
I haven't, and I normally carry, in case of an emergency, I carry like a wall socket. Obviously, I've got all my USB cables, so just in case I do need to stop, like in a McDonald's is always a good place to stop because they have Wi-Fi. You know, you can plug into the wall in case you need to charge things up, and of course, get yourself a few Big Macs as well while you're at it. Not for me though, because I'm vegetarian. So
chips. I mean, that is a great source
chips
of fuel.
Yeah,
carbs and salt. I mean, chips is literally the perfect thing. And I've seen people filling their top tube bags with chips.
I can't. I'm yet to be initiated on that myself, because I can't imagine like the amount of cleaning afterwards. You know, dealing with a greasy bag for the rest of your life. So.
Well, the final thing I wanted to talk about on the safety subject was, if you look around the yard here, pretty much every rider has some sort or other of visibility strap. So is it the Monkey C straps that you've got on? And these are, I think there's a couple of different brands that you can get with these, and they just strap around your middle and over your shoulders, and it's a fluorescent yellow stripe with a reflective strip, and it just helps you be seen in the dark.
Yeah.
Have you ever had any safety concerns, or is this pretty much all you need?
You can never have, you know, enough things to keep you safe on the road. The more the better, really. I've got two rear lights, and I also carry a spare one I think actually when I did the race 2 years ago, I managed to lose one of my lights during the night, and you know, you're not going to go back and look for your light, or it could be anywhere. So what I do now is I normally carry a spare light with me. It's so important to have those rear lights, and obviously the visibility at night as well. So.
Well, Nikki, I better let you go. It is 10 to, riders lining up in 5 minutes. Best of luck, and I'll be following your dot. Might even see you at the finish unless you arrive at 3 a.m. in which case I'm sorry, I'm not gonna get up for you, but good luck, have a safe trip.
Thank you so much. My personal aim is to arrive back on Monday night, so hopefully see you then.
So I've got a few more minutes until the riders set up, and I am just getting hold of my good friends Hannah Larblessier and Liam Bromley, who are riding as a pair, and they have told me, I'm not going to say it too loudly, that their secret ambition is not only to win the pairs but to win the race. So how are you two feeling? You got 10 minutes to go. Sorry, I'm broadcasting it to the nation now.
Well, I don't know. Well, I think we'll be happy just to get around in a decent time, but I think we can be competitive. We'll just see how it goes, because we haven't really done anything like this before.
Well, Hannah, you were explaining to me yesterday or the day before about, you know, I thought that a pair would go faster because obviously you can draft each other, but actually sometimes it doesn't work like that, does it? And sometimes you can actually slow each other down.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, like, the places that you're going to lose time on a race like this are when you're stopping for buying food or going for a wee or sleeping, and quite often that faff time doesn't necessarily synchronise between pairs riders. So you have to
accommodate the needs of both people, so it's kind of, yeah, if one person's having a bad time of it, then the other person's got to slow down. So,
and how do you deal with differences in fitness? Obviously a man and a woman, yeah, it's likely that you're going to have different fitness. Do you find that actually it's no problem riding together and you kind of spur each other on, or can it lead to perhaps a divorce?
Well, we're pretty used to riding together, aren't we?
I think it can work quite well, because I think obviously I'm a bit slower than Liam, but in the long run, that's probably a good thing for Liam to have to slow down to accommodate my pace a bit, because it'll mean that he's a bit fresher towards the end. And like on all the flat sections, I can just sit on his wheel and let him do the work. But then obviously, like, if I'm feeling a bit stronger, then I can take the front and let him have a break. Yeah, I mean, we're quite used to riding together, so I hope it goes well.
Finally, on the tech side of things, anything special with your setups?
Mine's just standard road bike. Rim brakes, 28mm tyres, so nothing special.
I'm on tubeless 28mm tyres, which the mechanic has just told me my rear tyre is set up back to front, which I wish.
Well, Hannah, you told me my rear tyre, my husband put my rear tyre on my bike back to front, it's been like that for months, so yeah, it's fine.
And there's nothing that special. I'm on ETAP Axis gears, so I'm hoping the batteries last for the whole event.
Do you have a spare one?
I have a charger, so I can charge them if I need to. And then I've got some tri-bars on the front, full frame bag, and then my seat pack is full of my sleep system. So in comparison to a lot of people, I feel quite like I'm carrying quite a lot of stuff. But
so you guys are planning to sleep then?
For a couple of hours at most.
Well, good luck. Wishing you a safe passage, and hopefully to see you here on Monday evening.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's 5 minutes to the start, and I've just found pair number
76,
and they're on a tandem, so obviously they're riding this race as a pair. Can you guys just quickly introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Laura, and this is Stevie. We're known as Stella Tandem.
Brilliant, and I guess you guys have done this before. It looks like you've done this before.
Not this ride before, but we've ridden lots of Audaxes before, so this is, yeah, first time I've had a bash at this one, so yeah.
Can you quickly run me through your tandem setup?
Well, yeah, so it's a bicycle made for two. It's a fairly heavy machine, and yeah, we've kind of got a bit of a trad setup. So we've got two panniers on the back, and I've got a little nose bag. Steve's got the aero bars at the front, and yeah.
Yeah, Dawes Galaxy Twin, Brooks Saddles.
Oh, we moved the mattress too.
Very traditional, yeah, and they have two mattresses on the back. And how are you hoping to fare in this pairs competition?
We would just love to get round. Our main aim is just to finish, because yeah, if we can get here for 8 p.m. on Tuesday, we'll be over the moon. It be a really tough ride on a tandem. So yeah, I think we're brave for giving it a go.
I think you're really brave. There's some very steep hills, but I believe in you guys. And how have you coped with the news about the firing range up at the northern point?
Yeah, we had that all in hand. Yeah,
So you knew it was
coming. We spent so long, because especially with the tandem as well, we need to keep it flat. We can't be on too rough terrain, for example. We're not a gravel bike. So yeah, we spent so long planning. Yeah, so that was sorted.
Well, it is brilliant to see a different kind of setup racing this race. And yeah, good luck to you both. Wishing you a safe journey. And I hope to see you back here on Monday or Tuesday evening.
Amazing, thank you.
Good luck. Thanks. What's it like? I should have asked before. What's it like being behind for 3 days? Can you see where you're going?
Not really. Going downhill takes a lot of getting used to because it's basically blind. So yeah, I get the view from the side, but I mostly stare at Steve's lower back. So that's 72 hours staring at Steve's lower back.
Maybe you can actually have a sleep. Okay, right, riders are off now. This is very exciting. A lot of nervous faces here. The sun is just going down. Lots of lights on, all the monkey see straps, and the riders are about to get ready for a 1,000 kilometre, roughly, trip around the north of England.
3, 2, 1, go!
And they're off!
Well, Lizzie, before we heard from the competitors at the start of that, can I call it a race? Is it all right?
Well,
it,
that's the thing. It's a race that's not a race. That's how they describe it.
But you mentioned Mark Beaumont taking part in GB Giro. Actually, Mark, he won that race, but he was recording for the cycling podcast at the time. I don't actually know when he got time to record, because I don't think
I was going to say he could have won it by a bit more if he hadn't bothered recording for the cycling podcast.
But keep your eyes, that's going to be a special episode coming out soon, so keep your eye out for that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, thanks as ever to Science in Sport for their continued sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast and Service Course and all the other great things that we do over here. Recently, Rich asked all of us how many grand tours we'd done with the Cycling Podcast, and I was trying to tot it up. I think I've probably done approximately 19, maybe 20, maybe 18, give or take, grand tours. And Science in Sport have been with us for all of those, so thank you as ever again to Science in Sport. And if you, like me, need to re-up on your Science in Sport goodies, then go to scienceinsport.com, enter the offer code SISCP25, and you get 25% off. That's SISCP25.
Well, we'll be going back to All Points North to catch up on the progress of the riders at the end of the episode, so do stay tuned. But in the meantime, we're going to throw back to the Olympics and the Paralympics. Feels like a world away now, but it was only just a month ago. And what a spectacular feast of tech it was. I mean, I wish I could have been on the ground and kind of, had a look at these skin suits. And, you know, did you see that New Zealand skin suit? What was it made of? Looked like a scuba diving suit.
Yeah, I mean, if you hadn't seen cycling for a while and you'd come back to it, you'd be like, what on earth has happened to this sport? What is it? Because it just looked radically different, didn't it, on the TV?
Yeah, I mean, the GB bikes were wild. But there were some big thrills and spills, particularly at the Olympics. And of course, you might remember that we saw the spectacular bar failure of the Australian team pursuit. Thankfully, the riders involved were okay, because, if that had been rider number one, it could have been a really, really, really bad crash. So thankfully, they were okay. But it does call into question, you know, there are a lot of these bar manufacturers out there. And my husband's an engineer, and we've kind of been thinking about it and wondering, well, how much engineering is there in these bar designs? And I think it must have been quite a difficult time for the teams competing afterwards. The GB team were actually up straight after the Australian team, and the Australian team had to go and do their run again, knowing what had happened before. And that fear is really, really challenging. But
Also, both at the Paralympics and Olympics, we saw some spectacular world and Olympic records fall. In particular, the men's team pursuit final was absolutely thrilling. I'd have to say, actually, that the women's team pursuit world record was probably a more spectacular drop in terms of numbers. We expected the men's team pursuit record to fall, but the women's fell by a lot. But the men's team pursuit final was just spectacular. With that in mind, I spoke to my former teammate, Martina Alzini, who is in the women's team. The reason I spoke to her is because I felt that, knowing a little bit about how the Italian Federation works, that there is so much more there that meets the eye than meets the eye with the Italian team. And I think if they had the resources that other countries like GB, like the USA, Germany had, what could be done there? So I had a good chat with Martina about the Olympics and her experience and where she thinks she can go from now. So Martina, fresh from the Tokyo Olympics, first of all, how does it feel to be an Olympian?
Wow, for me, this is amazing. It's the dream of a career. It's something that I dream a lot. And when I was a child, every time I watch the Olympics in TV and lots of sport, and make me so motivated and so inspired to one day be there that, yeah, my dream come true. So I'm really happy about this. And I felt lots of emotion in Tokyo, also new emotion for me. And for me, it was just a roller coaster of new things and nervous, anxious, but also really inspired to do my best, you know, and be part of a team representing my nation that I love. It's something that, yeah, was amazing for me.
I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you was, I mean, we couldn't not notice the men's team pursuit team. They set the world record three times over and won the gold medal. And that is incredible. But I think sometimes we forget to look at the places beyond first, second and third. And you guys actually were sixth overall. You qualified fourth in the first round, which is actually the qualification round. And then there's what is called the first round, which is actually the second round. And then in the third round, which is the finals, you were sixth overall. But what I see is a squad full of potential. And knowing a little bit about what the Italian Federation is like, and also knowing a little bit about the resources in the British Federation, the German Federation, Australian, etc., etc., I see such a huge kind of room for improvement there with the Italian Federation. And I remember back at the beginning of last year when we were teammates, and that was going to be an Olympic year, and you were telling me that actually you hadn't really used training peaks or power meters. So, I mean, is that something that you then started to utilize? Because these are things that are, you know, mainstay things for any other federation, really.
Yeah, this is true. You're telling right, because it's the first year for me that I'm using a power meter on the track. And yeah, I'm not saying it's right or not right. It's our kind to work, you know, and for sure we are a young, talented team, but being young is not the reason to our sixth place, because for me, yeah, for sure we hoped for a medal, also if we knew that was really, really difficult. But yeah, we came home with a new Italian record for 10.0. is really nice for us, and we came home with such a strong motivation to getting better in Paris, and yeah, going Paris for fighting for a medal and for the victory. Why not? And for sure, the new world record and the gold medal of the men get us really, really inspired. And in my opinion, for me, it was inspired also looking at the German team in the women team pursuit, because, wow, we're amazing. The new world record and their gold medal, for me, is speechless, you know. And also because we are talking about some girls that are racing with us both in road and in the track. So yeah, you are saying right, because for me, we can getting better in lots of points, for example, to the aerodynamics, maybe analyze better our performances, and yeah, something we can change in better, you know, for racing in Paris with more confidential team, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mention about kind of the equipment and handlebars, because yeah, we saw that the new Pinarello bike came out last year or at the end of 2019, and it's a great bike, claims to be one of the fastest, and you know, really the difference between the bikes is very, very small, but it's the aerodynamic position on the bike that makes such a big difference. And I think the handlebars of the Italian team, they kind of raised some eyebrows because everyone said, oh wow, look at those. And I guess the one thing that I noticed is, yeah, they're really cool handlebars, but I noticed how you guys are, you're quite high up. And so I wonder, have you done much testing in the wind tunnel? Because it's one of those things, it's great if you have really great handlebars, but it's also important to do a lot of testing. And I don't know if you guys have the funding that some other nations have in order to kind of test, and then once you've not just test and then try that position on the track, because it's so important to be able to hold that position when you're going full gas for 4 kilometers.
Yeah, this is another point that for sure we have to improve, because we went one time over the last year in a wind tunnel at the Polytechnic in Milano. So for me it's different trying the material and the position when you are not pedaling on a track in doing the maximum of your effort at 60 kilometers per hour. This is true. So maybe it's another point that we have to consider at, and for sure to getting better for the next 3 years. And I would like to say that it's not just positioning and doing the test on the wind tunnel, but also training your body to keep this position for 4 minutes. You know what I mean? Like also keeping the right position and the most aerodynamic position for me is a training.
Mm-hmm. And that's training on and off the track, isn't it? You know, there's so much strength work behind that, shoulder strength, neck strength, and it's that being able to build that up over time, and then being able to kind of practice being in that really, really extreme position. And so I guess with that aerodynamic input, I was wondering if there's much of a difference in facilities really between the men and the women, or do you think that there is, but it's down to the fact that, for instance, Ganna rides for Ineos Grenadiers, and so he gets the input from his trade team. And yeah, so is there a difference, and if so, why is that?
Yeah, this is for me a curious point, because we use the same skin suit as the men, and maybe in the future there will be some difference between men and women, because for sure the high velocity that the man can keep in a team pursuit is different between women. So maybe the different sponsor of skin suit, they will try a new fiber for the women, and because it's different, you know, maybe it's different, the texture is right, the skin suit, how can react at 60 kilometer per hour instead of 17, you know. So this is a curious point to develop for me. And also, you know, the same we have done the same with CASC this year, because I race with a different helmet instead of some other girl that race with another kind of helmet, just because when we went in the wind tunnel we have tried, we find out the difference that for me was better, the one who I used. And yeah, I think in the future will be the same with new helmet, maybe new kind of aerodynamic, and let's see.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was talking to the guys from Hoob Watt Bike,
about skin suits mm-hmm. last year, and it was so interesting to hear them say they'd been working with Vortec, and it wasn't only just the different speeds that you're traveling at, but each individual rider, just the way you hold your arms, the way your body shape is. Some of us have different size hips, different size boobs, and so all of those things, where you hold your head, they all make a huge impact on how the air hits you and how it flows over your body. And so one rider might put on what is supposedly a really fast skin suit, and actually it might be quite slow for them. And then as well, it's about how the air actually travels over the four riders in the line. So it's so complicated. It's not just your own aerodynamics and getting a fast position and getting a fast skin suit. It's a fast position for you. And I guess, again, another thing I noticed watching on TV is you can see on TV that GB, New Zealand, Germany, the Netherlands, they all have these skin suits that they bring out just for the Olympics. And for the other 3 years, they're locked away in a cupboard and you can't see them. And it seems like it seems to me that obviously we know the Castelli skin suits are fast, but maybe they're not the super, super fast Olympic ones that the other nations develop solely for the Olympics.
Yeah, maybe that's right. We use skin suit that maybe compared to other Olympic nation, for example, New Zealand, they use a new skin suit with a completely different texture instead of us. And I mean, this is for me another interesting aspect of the Olympics. Go there for see what the team developed in the past 3-4 years, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe we were there and we are looking about, you know, the new bike of GB team or the new skin suit of New Zealand team. And this is interesting because it's something about we for sure we will working on for the 3 years. Until Paris, and that's right, for sure, in a special in a team pursuit and in all the track events, for sure the technologies is really, really important for, you know, the performance of every athlete. So this is the direction that our discipline is taking, and I hope that for the future 3 years, Italy is taking the right direction, you know, with the right technologies.
Yeah, I guess that's another question that really comes back to funding, because is it the riders that are doing the research when you're on the ground at the Olympics, or do you have somebody in the team who's dedicated to you know, innovation, performance, that kind of thing? Is there a dedicated member of the team or a dedicated, I don't know, unit even in Italy?
Well, I mean, I'm talking, for example, I'm taking the man as an example. I read some articles that for the Rio Olympics, when Viviani won and there was a completely different kind of Omnium, he developed the texture of skin suit and other kind of materials by himself, thanks to his sponsor. But I think that's something he has done by himself. To be honest, I don't know if also for Tokyo was like this, but I think that, for example, with the men and with the World Tour team, they develop and they help our national team to become better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope for sure this helps a lot. And when you win, for sure you have done something something right.
Yeah, I just find it so interesting knowing about the difference in resources, really. And I wonder if, I mean, there's a lot of athletes on the women's side in Italy who are kind of in the pool and you could choose from. There's probably 10 athletes who are up there and could be picked for the team pursuit team, and it's just trying to decide which ones. And if you gave those riders the opportunities and facilities that other nations had,
where would you guys be? And that's everything. That's training infrastructure, altitude camps, heat training, equipment. It's really the full package. And I think unless you have that 100% full package, you can't be the Olympic champion and you can't really get a medal. And so I just wonder what you could do as a team if you had those resources. And I think it's really, really fascinating. And I hope that over the next 3 years, you know, with the result of the men and with the inspiration and, you know, the team will get more funding and a better infrastructure, I think, because it definitely seems to me from the outside like Italy is a little bit behind. I think everybody's always behind, you know, GB and Germany. They have a lot of money. But yeah, I just think that you guys could do so much. And I mean, did you do heat training in preparation for Tokyo?
To be honest, no. To be honest, I will say that I would like to say that we have been a bit lucky, because I think that heat training helps a bit more the road riders instead of us, because heat training for me was something that I would have tried, but okay, it was not like this. And when we were in the velodrome, luckily it was not so hot inside the velodrome, and I think that that's another important point to say, because also the performances of, for example, the team pursuit, and some times were really, really amazing times. For example, the world record of the man, the world record of the woman, and also our national record. The track was really fast, I think, thanks to the heat, but also thanks to the kind of pressure inside the track. So, this for saying that for sure the track was hot, but the conditions weren't so extreme. You know what I mean? Like so hot, like for the road races or for other sports. For example, I listened to the tennis that were like impossible to play at some point because it was too hot. Fortunately for us, was not like this.
So it felt really, you know, not that far off what a normal track, apart from if you're in the UK, it felt what a normal track session might feel like for you when you were inside then, did it?
Yeah, you mean like...
in terms of temperature
Yeah, I mean, I found in some other World Cup quite similar temperature. For example, I remember the New Zealand one or the Australian one. And also there, the team pursuit, some teams set a really, really good time. But, I mean, I think that this track was with a really nice pressure. So it's also one of the factors that's why the team pursuit were so fast. And, because we know that maybe sometimes you can set a really fast time, and it's not because you have done the maximum of your watt. This is important, I think, to say sometimes, because maybe you can do a good performances, but the velodrome were and the track was not so fast as another track, you know.
It seems to me that the both the men's and women's world records are going to be pretty hard to beat, with everybody coming out of Tokyo saying that the track was just so fast that even with another, well, we only have 3 years instead of a 4-year development cycle now, and then we go to Paris, which is probably not going to be as hot. I think that we may see those records stand for a really, really long time.
Yeah, for me, especially the woman world record, it's something amazing. And, you know, the records are made to be to be smashed. So I don't know if this is the correct translate, but okay, in Italy we say like this, no? So when you made a record, you know that sometimes it could be smashed, you know, sometimes... Mm-hmm. Someone arrived and smashed your previous record. So For me, the woman record is something amazing. But for sure, I hope in the future to see some other crazy records like this. And yeah, I also hope for my national team to smash our Italian record for something better.
Yeah, and I think knowing how much more you guys have to give, not in terms of physical performance necessarily, but in terms of equipment and technology behind the team, I really think you will. And finally, I have to say, one of my favourite moments from watching the track at Tokyo was watching the men's team pursuit final, which was nail-bitingly close. And Italy just clinched it after pulling it back from 0.8 of a second down with three laps to go to plus 0.16 or something. And the Italian team, the rest of the Italian team in the stands, you and your teammates were just, you were absolutely losing it. You were having such a good time. And I think seeing that inspiration, seeing that inspiration firsthand, I sent you a photo. It was amazing.
For me, it was just an emotional moment because they made the history and we were there. So we girls, we start to cry and laugh and be so happy. And when we listen to our, the song, the Italian
national,
the Italian song.
Yeah.
Sorry. The national anthem on the podium. Yeah. So emotional, and I say to the other girl, imagine when we were like grannies, and on the TV they pass the historic moment on the sport, and we were watching this, we are watching this on the TV, and we can say to our son and to our family, I was there. So yeah, we laugh, but it's true. It's something that made the history, especially the Italian history of the sport. And that's why I say that for me is so inspiring, because be there and imagine that maybe one day we can also achieve this. For me, it's such a big motivation to keep going, to do what I'm doing, keep following my decision to race on the track and also on the road. But I really hope to be there in Paris. First we have to qualify, and second I have to be part of the selection, and third we must go for a medal. So I really hope, as you say, that we were young, but we can improve a lot, and in every kind of things that we can improve. So not only the performances, but also the aerodynamic components, the materials, and
everything.
I hope so. Yeah.
Well, good luck, Martina. I look forward to seeing you on that podium in 2024.
And I hope to see you at the Olympics too. I really hope.
Me too. Thanks, Martina.
You can do it, thank you so much, Lizzie.
Oh, do you know what, Lizzie? I've got so many questions re track cycling, but do you know what? I'm going to park a lot of them because I know full well that there are two very big hour record attempts happening in October. I can't tell you who's doing them, but I think...
I'm going to tell you, it's Joss Loudon and Dan Bigham. And, again, we expect to see...
I know three, that's the third one. Yeah, you've named two, there's another one that I know.
Oh, there is another one. Well, Alex Dowsett's going for it, but is he going for it in September or is it December? I'm not sure when Alex Dowsett's going for his, actually. But we expect to see a drop in the women's hour record from Joss Loudon. So it's going to be really interesting. Dan Bigham is not actually able to go for the overall hour record because he's not in the anti-doping world testing pool, which you have to be in order to qualify to do that. But he is trying to break the British record. So that's going to be interesting. But for now, back to All Points North. So I was dart watching the whole weekend and it was, a lot more exciting than it sounds. So we'll head back to there and find out who wins the 1,000 kilometer sprint. So it's Monday morning now, and I've been dot watching all weekend on the All Points North tracker. And every single rider has a dot, and each dot has a colour to indicate their status, and whether that's green for moving, orange for stationary, whether they're fueling, sleeping, and grey means the riders have scratched, which is that they've left the race. Unfortunately, one of our pre-race favourites, Nikki Shaw, has scratched for unknown reasons so far. Her tracker shows that she's scratched at Corbridge. But it's really fascinating kind of watching the race develop via a dot. And I woke up on Sunday morning, and was tracking everybody through the Lake District. And, you know, certain checkpoints, there's only so many ways you can go. Honister, Slate Mine, you go up through the Lake District, over Thirlmere, up to Keswick and up the Borrowdale Road. I know that area quite well. And I was looking at the dots and I saw one dot, number 54, just head off up the Langdale Valley. And I thought, hold on a second, that's a dead-end road. I know that road quite well. And of course, he then proceeded to just go all the way up the Langdale Valley, which is, I think it's a bridleway, but it's a pretty rocky bridleway. And it's also a long, long way over. You get to the top of the pass, and then you have to go a very long way down the Langstrath Valley before you get to a road eventually in Borrowdale. So I've been tracking number 54's progress, Logan Mills, and he's doing really, really well. So I would love to catch up with him at the end and find out what's going on. But for the moment, the main race seems to be between number one, Power Pulowski, the winner from 2019, and number 77, Bradley Woodruff. So these two riders both decided to go different ways, one clockwise, one anti-clockwise around the route. And at this point, they both have one checkpoint left. Paweł Pulowski, who is the favourite, has more distance to go, but his route will be a lot flatter and a lot simpler as he's now heading towards Beverley and then from Beverley over to Sheffield, where the roads are relatively flat and quite fast. Bradley Woodruff is heading to Leeds Pals Monument, which is near the top of Lofthouse in the Yorkshire Dales National Park. And then he's going to have to navigate his way back to Sheffield around Leeds and Wakefield, which may be much slower with traffic lights, etc. So it's going to be an interesting day following these dots, trying to guesstimate what time they're going to be back at the Healy Institute in Sheffield. And I'm really enjoying it. It's 3:30 on Monday now. The riders have been going for 43 and a half hours, pretty much nonstop. And there is a real sprint finish between bib number one, Paweł Pulowski, and bib number 77, Bradley Woodruff. So they're both coming from different directions. Paweł is over in Goole, and Bradley's up in Leeds. And it's really going to be so close. They've probably got about 2.5 hours of riding left. I just can't call it who it's going to be, but I'm really excited to keep watching those dots and get down to Healy Institute for the finish. Well, I'm just leaving home. It's the last 45, maybe, minutes of the race. After about 1,000 kilometres, it's coming down to a sprint finish, and it is still too difficult to tell who's going to win. So we're heading over to Healy now, and hopefully I'll update you soon. So I'm at the Healy Institute now. We're waiting for the first two finishers to come in, and they're both within the city of Sheffield. It's absolutely nail-biting. But in the meantime, I'm here with bib number 58, who's already back because unfortunately he had to scratch. First off, could you just introduce yourself, and then could you tell us the story of your race and what happened and why you had to scratch?
So I'm Vincent. I'm from Belgium, but I live in Cambridge now. And I think that's part of why I had to scratch, because I'm used to ride on flat. And you saw yesterday, after the night in the Yorkshire Dale, with the very, very steep climbs, I felt that, I was giving a lot. And then later in the day, Sunday, my knees starting to be painful. So I was trying to keep moving on with and to reduce the pain by putting ice and painkillers. It went fine, and then it came back. And then this morning it was just impossible to pedal. So I was pushing my bike. on the climbs and riding on flats and on descent, hoping, I don't know what, maybe that the pain will disappear. And then after, I don't remember, but maybe 40K like that, I realized that I had still 500K to do. So
you're only halfway through the race. Where did this happen then?
Just before Cockdale. Yeah, just before Cockdale. Yeah, in the climbs there. I really had to stop it. It was like a knife in my knee. It was really terrible. And then I stopped for 5-10 minutes. I've lowered my seat a little bit because I've heard that it can help. But then it was fine for 10 minutes, and then it's really terrible. I couldn't push the pedals. So yeah, it took me a time to send the message to say that I want to scratch. And after that, I took the bus and then the train to Sheffield, and now I'm here to see the exciting finish.
Oh, excitement here. I'd say number 77 has possibly gone the wrong way around the ring road, because it's actually the hilly way, and then number one is on the flat a bit, coming through town, just going under the viaduct, and then he's just got to come around the ring road. Or it is touch and go here at the Healy Institute. Oh my gosh, it is so, so close. The riders are both coming to the same set of traffic lights, and it could literally be a sprint up the final hill to the finish. So we are just waiting here now. The organisers have got their pots and pans to cheer the riders on. It is so different to any kind of bike race I've been to before, but also exactly the same. The riders probably don't know what's going on. We know what's going on, and we think we know what's going to happen. But yeah, it's getting to the end. It looks on the tracker like one of the riders may have even gone slightly the wrong way. They should be here by now. They should be meters away. We're just waiting for them to come round the final corner. Hey, I can see a bicycle cresting. Now, is that number 77? Bradley Woodruff has just arrived to the sounds of pots and pans, and we are awaiting the second place finisher, who is coming. We think he's just around the corner. Unbelievable. And here he is! Oh my goodness, would you believe it? That's been 30 seconds between the riders after 1,000 kilometres. What an unbelievable finish.
Amazing.
30 seconds.
What's happened?
30 seconds.
You came before?
Yeah.
Well done, man.
Bloody red light on the train.
No excuses. No, I'm joking.
Brad, how is it to have just completed a 1,000-kilometre trip around Britain and won?
Yeah. There's not much to say. I don't think the winning matters too much, to be honest. But no, it was a good ride. I'm absolutely zonked.
What was the hardest part for you?
Don't know, you have good spells and bad spells, so it's quite a lot of bad spells this time. Mainly the heat. The heat today and yesterday. That was the worst thing.
And you didn't expect that before? No. It wasn't really forecasted, was it?
No. So otherwise I wouldn't have worn a winter suit.
Yeah, so you've been wearing a winter race suit, which has got a thermal Roubaix thing, and arrived with it wrapped around his waist. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you couldn't ditch it, so there's nothing you could do, right?
No, this morning I literally stopped for a few hours. I was like riding my route, but freewheeling so that I didn't get too hot. But then even just being in the sun, I was too hot. So I'd stop for a bit, and then I just thought, well, I may as well just wrap it round me and carry on riding. There's not much else I could have done. If I had a t-shirt, I would have put a t-shirt on, but it was actually quite nice, to be honest, having the fresh air on you.
And how was your ride, pal?
Yeah, great. Very good.
So I think you got here second by about 30 seconds, and you said you were waiting for a train for about 5 minutes at the end of your ride.
Yeah, it wasn't 5 minutes, but I think 2 minutes for sure. Yeah, just down there.
Yeah, and it feels like forever.
It was red light. Yeah, I was thinking to do like an Alicat, you know. I used to do Alicats back in Poland, but I thought, nah, I better stop at red light.
And what was the hardest part for you?
I don't know, you know, there were some heavy climbs. It wasn't much from the route. The traffic today, at the second part of the day and in the morning.
My Lizine was going to run out of battery, so then I started recording on here. And now that's disappeared. Yeah. So, there it is, finish. I don't know.
Yeah. Do it again.
Come on, where are the stats?
Yeah, no, it's on two different devices, so I can't.
Too sleep deprived to add up. Understandable. Okay, I'm just going to get the stats from the ride from Powell, because Bradley's ride is uploaded in two parts, so too tired to add it all up. So, distance, overall distance.
956 k's.
Climbing?
Yeah, climbing. 13,700?
Fair.
Meters. yeah.
Fair number of meters.
I think 2019 was like about 9,000.
Nice. Yeah, 50% increase.
Yeah. And what else do you want?
Average moving speed over the 47 hours.
22.5, not really impressive. 4 hours stop, 42 hours, 36 minutes ride.
4 hours stopped overall?
Yeah. Too much.
It's interesting, because didn't you, in 2019, didn't you only rack up about 20 minutes of stopping or something like that?
No, it was sleep.
Okay.
But, you know, this year...
I was wondering how that
You know,
be
every
possible.
Checkpoint you have to stop. You have to find the answer for the question that is there. And some checkpoints, you know, most of them actually I did through the night. So finding the, you know, how old was the king or something like that, you know, of the monument.
You spend 5 minutes. Go like that, and you're just looking around trying to find the checkpoint.
So the checkpoint is often like a statue then or something, and it'll have some information on there that you have to photograph.
The one in Silverdale was a sign for a walk. And I was looking, I was like, yeah, torches out.
I guess I assumed that there would be someone sitting in the village hall who would sign you off, but no, it's not quite that easy.
Yeah, and for example, the most northern point, yeah. I mixed the names and I read the question for the wrong checkpoints about the gate. And I was checking all the gates around there looking for this signal, you know, initials that they were supposed to be on the reservoir, you know. And spend like 15 minutes for looking at it, and then I stopped. I mean, looked at the names again, and I realized that I'm looking at the wrong checkpoint. So yeah, that's probably why such a long stops. I would say 10 minutes for every checkpoint. You have 10 checkpoints, which is 100 minutes. Yeah.
Well, there we have it. After 1,000 kilometres, it came down to 30 seconds. I really couldn't believe it. It was nail-biting. It was thrilling. It was so different from a normal bike race, but just so similar. And yeah, I guess I'm hooked. You know, kind of want to go there next year myself. And it was a little bit mean of me to shove a mic in the face of two completely dead participants. But I guess I just wanted to catch up a little bit on a couple of the other people racing who we didn't get to catch up with at the finish. First off, I spoke to Nikki Shaw about her journey. So, Nikki, I woke up on Monday morning seeing your dot gone grey, which meant that you had to scratch. What happened? Because it was such a great race for you up till there. So what was the story?
It was all going really well. So the race started just how I planned. So I had my head down all the way up until Carlisle, which was about just over 300 kilometres into the race, just decided to stop there and refuel and then push on into the night, perhaps have a nap somewhere. So I went up to Kielder and then across a gravel section heading towards the northern checkpoint. And it was at the end of that gravel section that I noticed that my back wheel was starting to wobble, and I actually thought I'd broken a spoke. So I stopped to have a look at the wheel, and it was absolutely fine. I couldn't work out what was actually what was the problem. So I carried on, and then I stopped again because obviously something wasn't quite right. And then I realised it was the actual tyre. It was kind of bulging in a few places. So at that point, I didn't know what had happened or what had caused it, but obviously it's something that couldn't be fixed there and then. So it's tubeless tyres as well, so it wasn't like, you know, there's a problem with the tube or anything like that. But at this point it was sort of 8 o'clock at night, so it wasn't like, it was quite a remote stretch of the course as well, so it wasn't like, you know, there was a bike shop within cycling distance or anything that would be open anyway at that time of night. So the only choice really was to try and continue just in as safe as manner as possible. So I managed to get to Crawford by about 2 o'clock. It's quite a sketchy ride actually, because you know, just going down descents at sort of anything above 20 kilometres an hour, and the back wheel would be really starting to make the bike oscillate, and it just wasn't safe at all. So I got to Crawford about 2 o'clock, and I decided actually it's not a safe situation to be in. So I very luckily managed to find a public toilet, and which is open, so that's always nice. So I had a lie down there.
That's luxury for your ultra, for the average ultra cyclist.
Yeah, it actually started raining as well, and I just thought, oh my god, this is just horrendous now, you know. 1 minute the ride can be going really well, and then just within the matter of a couple of hours, everything can start to go wrong for you. So So
you had no option but to scratch. But actually the story continues, doesn't it? And I'm talking to you now 1 week later, and tell us what you've just done.
So it's like ages ago now, but I scratched on the race started on the Saturday night, and I had to stop on the, so it was the following night, and I got home on the Monday. And then I was back at work on, so I had 3 days of work, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then during that time, I when I scratched, it's already sort of, it was already planted in my head, you know, I'm not ready to scratch. It's purely a mechanical that has caused me to have to stop riding. So it wasn't like, you know, it was a decision on my part. It was just a decision more out of safety than anything else. So I was already thinking about, you know, how can I actually continue this ride? I don't have an injury to deal with. I've just got to get the right equipment. So I had to sort out a new pair of tyres in those 3 days that I was at work, which I managed to do. And then on the Friday night, I caught a train back up to Corbridge, arrived at Corbridge at 11:30 at night, and just continued my route just as I didn't go back to the public toilet. not quite there. So I went back to the train station, obviously got off the train, and then just continued the route and got home last night in time to go to bed at midnight. So it was quite a long day yesterday, let's say.
So Bradley Woodruff's overall stats were 967 kilometres, 13,390 metres of climbing, and 41 hours and 33 minutes moving time.
The winner in the women's event was Charlotte Thompson at 52 hours. The pairs event was my friends Hannah and Liam in 55 hours. And the tandem, who we heard from earlier in the show, they did it in 79 hours, which I think is just incredible. The weight of that thing and the extra distance they would have had to go was amazing. But I mean, just what an amazing event. It was so inspiring. And yeah, I'm actually trying to plan some really long day and all day adventures now. I think that's back on my to-do list as soon as I get the medical go-ahead. But yeah, what a great event. Absolutely brilliant.
Listen, is this catching on? We know in the men's peloton, it really has caught on, this kind of alternative racing, you know, don't just do the road, you know, do some stuff that really excites you, or, you know, gives you that love of cycling. But is the same spirit happening in the women's side of things? I mean, or do you even get the same freedom?
Yes and no. Generally no, but I think it's catching on in parts, and certain teams where the sponsors kind of identify with that kind of thing. Tiffany Cromwell has been doing some gravel racing for Canyon Tram this year. Lauren Stevens has also been doing some gravel ultra races. Are they ultra races? No, probably not ultra races because they're just one day, but you know, like 300 kilometer gravel races. Serious.
I'm going to say that's an ultra race. Okay. I'm going to call it ultra.
The emails going to come flooding in. Yeah. Please send them in.
Yeah.
But she's been doing that. She rides for Team Tibco Silicon Valley Bank. And I guess it's their sponsor Cannondale who are really pushing that. It's quite interesting to see the motivation of different teams. Some teams are very pure, you know, road races. And then actually you have teams like Ineos Grenadiers who perhaps you wouldn't think of them to be more alternative. But we've got Tom Pidcock doing cross, you know, he's now the Olympic mountain bike champion and he's an absolute beast on the road. So perhaps as people do kind of become more diverse in what they do and teams see the benefit of it with, you know, rider happiness and welfare, and actually they're more motivated because they're doing more diverse things, perhaps it'll become, you know, more common in the pro peloton. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be really interesting to watch the development of gravel racing and seeing kind of which pros do it whilst they're racing or which pros just retire and go straight into gravel racing. But I think it's great. I think it's a really good way to get more people riding their bikes. And to be honest, the more people we have riding bikes, the better.
Well, Lizzie, I was going to end the show. I was going to be a bit mean. I was going to ask you which team you would be trying to persuade to let you do these events. But I'm going to leave people hanging. I'm not going to ask that question. Thanks ever so much, Lizzie. We will find out more about what you're doing next season in due course, I am sure.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Tom. Good to catch up with you and see you soon.